I do have a lot of fun with that gong, I have to say. I'm so happy that it's back, because that was one of, for me, one of the most fun things about our previous center down on Grub Street was that every week we would have somebody down at the bottom of the stairs hitting the gong to let people know it was time to come and meditate, or letting people know that it was time to come and hear the Dharma talk. So for me, it's kind of like a nostalgic, nice sound from the past to hear it again. So it may or may not have that effect on you, but it's nostalgic for me. So I appreciate you indulging my nostalgia coming here this morning. Also, I wanted to let everybody know that this week we'll be observing the second of the great, the first actually of this year, of the great four great occasions in the life of the Buddha. This one will be this coming Friday. I'll be here at 8 o'clock to lead a 1 hour practice and change, 1 hour and change of the Chenrezig practice. To help people accumulate some merit and do some meditation on one of the sacred days of our tradition, which is the observance of the Buddha's performance of miracles. And during the break, I got involved in a conversation about how it was possible for the Buddha, who was not a god, to perform miracles. And I said, well, it all comes down to what we believe about enlightenment. Do we believe that enlightenment is somehow a static state? You know, it's kind of like, you know, where it's like almost like a passive state where nothing happens. Or if we think of enlightenment as being somewhat dynamic and capable. And I think that's really what it comes down to. There was a wonderful article about this written by the Buddhist scholar Reginald Ray. And his opinion was that the reason that the Buddha and other enlightened beings could perform miracles, such as making water appear from nowhere, making flowers appear from nowhere. When he walked, remember, even as a baby, flowers grew from his feet, from the earth where his feet touched. This sort of thing is part of the idea that enlightened beings can work, shall we say, transdimensionally. They can do things that otherwise would not be understandable by science. But you can also interpret these stories of the life of the Buddha as legends that have an instructional meaning. So there's two ways to absorb the teaching of the Buddha's miracles. One is as a symbol of all of the things that are capable or possible for a person who has attained enlightenment, a showing, if you will, of the qualities of enlightenment, that enlightenment is dynamic and not static. But you could also see them as merely being legendary stories that instruct us on the Buddha's capability of doing whatever was needed by the people of that era in order to encourage them to practice the Dharma. If you remember the stories about India at that time, there were a lot of these spiritual debates, if you want to call it that, where people would debate philosophy. But the Buddha actually didn't debate philosophy. What he did instead was perform miracles day after day for 15 days, which is why the first 15 days of the lunar New Year in Tibetan Buddhism, these 15 days that we are currently in, are called the month, or really half month, of miracles. And so it's really a good thing to remember that even though we are not enlightened beings now, and we may feel that enlightenment is a long way off for us, we might think it's a long way off, that there is a potential for us to attain a state of mind and a state of being that is beyond what we experience right now, with capabilities that are beyond what we experience right now. This past Tuesday, we invited some friends from the Jewish temple to come and visit with us. And there were about 20 of them and about 10 of us. So we had a big crowd down here on Tuesday night. We did a short practice of Chenrezig. As I was going upstairs, a young boy said to me, someone said that the Buddha performed miracles. Is that true? And we talked about that. And I said, yes, but the real miracle is not making something appear from nowhere. The real miracle is being able to tame your own anger when you really feel like you want to yell at somebody. To me, that's the real miracle, is to transform my own anger or my own impatience in the moment and to feel love, to feel love and compassion in a situation where I don't feel like having love and compassion. To me, that's the real miracle. So anyway, he thought that was interesting. So this is the blessing and wonder of talking to 12-year-olds about Dharma. We also had a group of sixth graders in here on Thursday from the Wellington School, and they asked a lot of really excellent questions as well. So this center provides an enormous amount of information for people of all ages. We do school groups, we have adults come to visit us, and it's all about Dharma. So it's kind of nice. But now I have to move from my general remarks to the book that we're studying. Because I asked Eric Weinberg, who's working with me on teaching this book, and Marcus Casey is also helping teach this book on meditation. It's called Meditation Advice for Beginners. And the reason I like this book is because it is so plain spoken. Not a lot of fancy explanations. It's just meditate and your mind will improve. That's his message. Meditate and your mind will improve. And then he goes into details talking about what meditation is, what it isn't, and how we do it. So get ready. There will be no quiz, but there will be some lab today. So I'm going to start by reciting the four-line refuge prayer in the Tibetan language. If it's a prayer with which you're familiar, you can join in. If it's a prayer with which you are unfamiliar, you can join in your heart and in your mind and dedicate this session of discussion and teaching to the benefit of all suffering beings. I'll only recite it once. O Sanje Chudang Soji Chonahamla Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin Soji Bei Sunaham Ki Drola Pinshir Sanjay Truparsho. O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi Or Pede Ten Shula Kajin Jembo Kone Che Sung Te Kusum tugging a trip south to song. Okay, thank you. When we talk about meditation, we talk about basically a technique or a set of techniques that helps us tame our mind. And there is a reason why this is important. And that is, I don't know if your experience is like my experience, but frequently my mind is rather untamed. Have you been here? Like, you're sitting in your car and you're waiting at a stoplight and you're wondering why the stoplight does not change. I think what happens is that our mind gets the better of itself sometime and our habits push and push and push. They push us into habits of thinking, and it's almost like we're in a rut. We're in a bit of a rut with our habitual negativities and negative feelings and things like, why don't people do what I ask, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't they work fast enough? Why don't they do what I think is important, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is why the Buddha said it was necessary to tame our thought processes, because it's our thought processes that give rise to the words that come out of our mouth. There's a Buddhist text that says, the mind is the monarch, and the speech and the body are the subjects. The mind is the one that tells us what to do, how to think, what to say. We don't accidentally go by someone and smack them and then say, oh, I'm sorry, that just happened. I don't know why. It doesn't work like that. Our mind formed the wish to do something, and so the body carried it out. So this is why we have to start by taming the mind. And what we have to tame, first of all, is the chatter of the mind. I don't know about you. Did anybody else have chattering mind? Any chattering mind? Oh, very good. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what your favorite chatter is. Anybody have, let's see, negative self-commentary? All right. Okay. Anybody have negative commentary about other people? All right. So we're all together here. And so what happens is that all of this chattering tends to lead us into bad directions, like saying things that we later regret and have to apologize for. I'm just, of course, talking about myself. You may have also experienced this. So what we have to do is we have to tame the mind. But how do you tame your mind? It is kind of wild. Well, first thing we have to do is we have to understand how to tame the mind. And the Buddha, when giving instructions on meditation that are then quoted in this book by Bokhar Rinpoche, the two phrases that get used are body at ease, mind at ease. Body at ease, mind at ease. So, in other words, if you can place your body in a position of, shall we say, relative comfort, relative comfort, we can put our body in a place of relative comfort, the mind will follow suit. That's the theory. It's a theory. Your mileage may vary, but it's a theory. And the meditation posture that was taught by the Buddha to his first disciples is still the one we teach today. And Bokhar Rinpoche, this is where the laboratory aspect of this class comes in. In his book, Bokhar Rinpoche teaches the posture and encourages people to sit in the posture first and then to apply the mental technique of mind at ease. So first things first, the body. If you're sitting in a chair, you sit with your feet flat on the floor. And if your feet will not touch the floor, you put a cushion under them so that you have that nice 90-degree angle with your feet flat on the floor, about hip-width apart, about hip-width apart. And your trunk should be straight, as though there were a string from the top of your head, and your vertebrae are nicely stacked upon one another. Your hands, if you're sitting in a chair, can be placed palm downward on the legs. This is the meditation posture taught by Marpa the translator, the first great master of Tibet. It's a grounding posture. It grounds you. And it also opens up the chest. And then the chin can be tucked in slightly. The eyes can be cast downward a few feet ahead. Or you can close them lightly. When your eyes are open, you are gazing, not looking. You're not putting a commentary on what you're seeing. The tip of the tongue can be touched to the upper palate behind the front teeth as a way of relaxing the muscles of the face. So, sitting in a chair, then, one can both have this sort of open chest and torso, balanced hands and shoulders, tucked in chin, downward gaze. If you're sitting on the floor, you can sit in any one of the cross-legged postures that are possible for people. Some people prefer to kneel on a kneeling bench. That's good too. Bokar Rinpoche, like many of the Tibetan lamas, says that the very best posture is the is what's called the lotus posture in yoga, where the left foot is on the right leg thigh and the right foot is on the left thigh. Which the reason I'm demonstrating this with my arms is I can't do it with my hands. I mean, I can't do it with my feet. The reason he says this is because this is the best posture to use for the hand mudra called equipoise, which is the left hand on the bottom, the right hand on the top with the two thumbs touching. He says it's really only possible when you're sitting in lotus posture. Otherwise, he said, you're artificially holding your hands and it can put with some tension and then you can maybe slouch a little bit. So what some people do is that they actually rest their hands and they're up on the tops of their upturned feet. And that's how it's possible to sit that way. But I don't know about you, but I can't sit in the lotus posture, which they call the diamond posture. So I prefer to use Marpa the translator, where the hands can be placed palm downward in the legs, or Kempa Rinpoche says you can place the thumb at the base of the ring finger and close your hands in a light fist and put them palm downward on your legs. In either case, you see what it does? It opens up your chest so that your chest doesn't sink or your shoulders round. So this is the physical posture. Again, chin tucked in slightly, eyes cast downward. The tongue can touch the upper palate behind the front teeth. Both Kempa Rinpoche and Bokar Rinpoche recommend just resting in this posture for just a moment, not attempting to do anything, but just absorb the feeling. And then placing the mind consists of beginning with one deep breath. Breathing deeply, breathing out, and then allowing the breath to come and go naturally. Bokar Rinpoche tells us to guard against thinking, I am meditating. Instead, he says that one places one's attention on the breath as it comes and goes without forming an opinion about what it is. He says, if one remains in a state of attention without distraction and open to yourself, your mind as it is without tension, he said, that's the best kind of meditation. Well, it's not possible immediately. So what we should do instead, he says, is place our attention on the breath as it comes and goes. He said the correct manner of placing the mind is important. Often, he said, there is a tendency to approach meditation in a very tense manner, in a state of forced non-distraction. So he said, what's better to do is to notice distraction, let it go, and return your attention to the breath for a fresh start. So that's what we're going to do for the next couple of minutes. Here's the lab. You place your body in the posture of meditation, and then form the mental wish, I am going to practice breath awareness for the benefit of sentient beings. Take a deep breath, let the breath out, and then you can follow the movement of the breath in and out. When you notice that your mind is attentive not to the breath but to the past or the future, you can label what is happening, thinking. Let go of the thought and return your attention to the breath for a fresh start. We'll sit for just a few moments. Okay. Discussion. How was it? Easy? Difficult? Problem? Anybody want to share something about their meditation? Was it easier with the posture or more difficult with the posture? Relaxing. Good. That's a good place to start. Anybody else have something they want to share about meditation? Easy, hard? Yes?
I think
when you get into the posture, your body relaxes, but your mind turns on. That's a very good comment. The person is saying that they notice their thoughts more. And I wonder if maybe that is in it. It's not that we have more thoughts, but it's that we notice their presence, whereas before it might be unnoticed. I have a lot of people tell me that. What's that?
There's a lot going on.
Well, you know, it really is kind of revelatory, isn't it? You know what was hard for me? What was hard for me is knowing how much I was thinking and then how much stuff I was thinking that made no sense. I don't know. Does that happen to you? Yeah. You know, like, I'm thinking that about that? Oh, my. You know, because I think there's a subtlety where we just think that we're really good people. Not that we're not, but I mean, we have this default position that, like, I'm a pretty good person. But then when we realize how many micro judgments we make of both ourselves and other people, it's kind of like, it's a little hard to take responsibility for that. I don't know about you, but that was hard for me. But what's good about that is that you notice. Are you able to come back when it wanders off? Usually? Well, if you're able to come back, that's really, that's kind of good. It means you've gotten used to the technique. Remember when Eric was talking about this a couple of weeks ago, he quoted the Tibetan name Gom, G-O-M, you know, which means getting used to. And that he said meditation is not some sort of, sort of beyond the normal. It's just getting used to your mind. Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you. Other stuff to discuss. People, yeah. 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 I think what you're saying is really true. There's a lot of awareness that comes to you when you are not busy attending to whatever your mind is telling you to do next. And so when you're, and when your eyes are down, cast down, you're not as involved with your eyes, and so you, your hearing does become a little bit more attentive. And the cool thing about that is that at first there's a distractive aspect to the sound. At first it's somewhat distracting because it causes me, I don't know about you, but it causes me to spin off a bit into thinking about, well, like, what is that person doing, and, you know, why is that person shifting or whatever, you know. But, and of course, see, that's hard because I'm always the one who's, I'm always the one who's. Anyway, but I think that over time, that also can become, in a way, like a thought, attending to that sound briefly and then letting it go and then consciously returning the attention to the breath for a fresh start. It's like you get to fresh start all the time. That's cool, though. It's really cool. Did you have something, Jim?
Mm-hmm. Then there are still days when it isn't.
Uh-huh.
And so for me, the other thing I've learned with passage of time and the delusions I tell myself of, like, oh, well, by now you can sit down and you know you have had times when it's calm and you have.
Right.
You can keep bringing back or gently. And then I'm very, very, I allow myself to be very, very forgiving of that.
Mm-hmm. Boy. Tush on the cush. I think we're going to make an embroidery of that.
And that's like 90% of the job, mm-hmm. is to cut out the time and get there and trust that process.
Right. I really appreciate what you're saying, and it's making me super regretful that I didn't have like a hand microphone so that everybody could hear that clearly. But I'll try to repeat a little bit of it. I think what was really valuable about what you were saying is that at first when you were meditating, you had a lot of bringing it back, and it was a bit of a struggle, but then over time that got easier and easier and easier, so that now you have more facility, if you want to say it that way, more ease with the technique, so that you can redirect your attention back more readily and more easily. And I really appreciate what you're saying about trying not to judge your meditation, not saying, oh, well, my meditation is good or my meditation is bad. But as you say, put your tush on the cush. I think that's just like, that's really marvelous. And that is, as you say, 90% of your meditation is just getting to the seat. And then from there, what did I miss of what you said? Was that close? Yeah. Oh.
They're taking up my time. That's why I play my bed and bowl tape out there. And this time, I didn't have the mic, and it came on, and it's the only time it's happened in years of doing this up there. I heard kind of a tone thrown in it, like a Tibetan bowl.
Yeah. Yeah. Once again, I just so regret, because your descriptions are so articulate, and I really appreciate your sharing. Did everybody hear it? Or because I can repeat a bit. He was talking about having a mini breakthrough this week, because behind your meditation house is a business that has an HVAC unit, you know, and it has a loud noise, and that you've felt somewhat, shall we say, resentful? I made that word up, but about the sound, that it was disturbing your meditation, and that you would play a tape of Tibetan bowls to cover that up. And then now, this week, you heard a tone when you heard that unit come on. And for you, that was like a relaxation moment. Did I get it right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, cool. I love that. Because Kemper Rinpoche told me once, We were in a group of practitioners, and some people were trying to do silent meditation while other people were doing their mandala offerings, which is rice going on top of a metal bowl, right, as they're making their offerings. And people were getting really irritated because they were trying to meditate, and other people were making this sound, you know, with the rice, like, why are you disturbing my meditation? And so Rinpoche, he is the best person to give you difficult information and make you feel like you've just been complimented. The man has a gift I could never possess, but I would love to have it. He said, well, you know, he said, that sound, he said, that sounds the sound of Dharma. Why do you resent that? Ooh, you know, so, but then you said, yes, sir, may I have another? I mean, you know, the idea is that he's basically saying to you that there are some sounds that you can actually adjust to, and that your mind actually has the power to adjust to things. And I just think that's just marvelous, isn't it?
And it wasn't anything intentional.
I know. It wasn't intentional. Boy, isn't that the way? I mean, it really is. I think that this really speaks to what Eric was describing a couple weeks ago when he talked about GOM, G-O-M, getting used to. And I think that that's a lot. So thank you for sharing about that. That's kind of cool. Yes. Yeah, tush on the cush, okay. Sure. And I want to make sure I understand about what you're saying about walking meditation. When you do walking meditation and you say, it all falls away, tell me what that means to you. More busyness? I understand. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I appreciate you clarifying that for me, that it's harder to be present when you're moving. I understand. And I think that this speaks to our difference as human beings. I know it's a very strange thing. We all have, like, you know, two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, and faces, and all this kind of stuff. So we think we're all kind of alike, but we really are incredibly different. And this is another example of how we're different. Some people have like a kinesthetic being. They can't sit still. So for them, walking is very important. But other people do prefer the quietness of the sitting posture, and that they find they're able to bring their mind to a place of attention more easily that way. And so maybe what you can do is, when you're moving, place your attention on the feeling of the feet. Just that. Lots of other things, like the unit in your alley that goes, you know, or the sound of people moving, or things like that, you know, may all come to you, but you can place your attention and return it to that, just that feeling, as your heel touches, and then the toes, and then it lifts, and then the heel and the toe touches of the other foot and lifts. Try that to see what's going on there. It could be that walking meditation is not for you. You know what I mean? And that it's better for you just to remain sitting. But it's very interesting to challenge, for us to challenge ourselves a little bit, and to kind of look at the frustration that we feel a little bit, and then let go of that moment of wobbly and frustration that we might feel with the meditation, and go back to the feeling of the feet and see if that helps. It'll be interesting, because I think that is a growth situation. Because I was really bad with sound at first. I didn't like any kind of sound happening while I was meditating. So that was my challenge. It wasn't movement, because, like, movement is like, vacation, you know. But I didn't get it right away, you know. But anyway, but I think it's interesting to challenge yourself and see. And let's talk about it some more, okay? And let me know how that goes for you. And if it continues to be a challenge, let's talk some more. Because it could just be that walking meditation is not for you. But what's really good about it is that if we can mix a quiet attentiveness with activity. You know what I'm saying? It's like if we can mix this sort of non-judgmental, open, spacious attentiveness with some simple activity, there's some potential there to overcome some of the habitual tendencies that arise with activity. I'm just saying. So, anyway. Yes? Isn't that what MARPA did? Yes, speaking of MARPA, yeah. MARPA was a farmer, and so he was able to sort of mix his mind with activity and be in this sort of calm space no matter what he was doing. So he's like, my hero. Yes, Ron?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I hope this is working. No? I was just thinking that walking meditation, when I do walking meditation, there's either the, there's like a threefold recitation, which is like when you're moving your feet, lift, carry, plant.
Oh, lift, carry, plant as the walking meditation?
And uh-huh. just keep your mind on the walking part.
Yeah.
And if you do it mm-hmm. well enough, it kind of blocks out.
Other people do use blocks. A recitation when they walk, lift, and plant, and so forth. Yeah. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche said the Tibetans never did walking meditation, so he said he kind of had to make it up. You know, he kind of had to make it up, so he didn't use other types of reminders like that. He just went with the feeling of the feet because that was what was contacting the floor. I'm really enjoying the discussion. Oh, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure I understand the first part of your sentence. Could you please repeat it for me?
Yeah, so when I'm doing sitting meditation in a chair, mm-hmm. it feels like a very tense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like if you heard someone like drop a stack of books.
Oh, yeah. You'd be startled.
Kind of like that.
You know, I get it. Yeah. I really do understand this because this was me, you know, when I first started meditating too. I would get severe pains in my legs and my back because I would just be holding so much tension. And I think there's a couple ways to work with that. Some people recommend doing gentle stretching exercises before a person would actually sit to meditate. But then I would spend a little extra time with your body at the beginning, and place your body in this position of meditation, making sure that the chest is sort of open like this, so you're not caving in on your chest, you know, because that can actually induce some obstacles into your practice, you know. So just being straight like that, but then, after one's done that, taking in that first deep breath and then breathing out, imagine that all of the tension is leaving your body as you breathe out. The Tibetan doctor, Akong Rinpoche, recommended what some people call balanced breathing. So you could try this before your session, just as after you've placed your body in the posture of meditation, that you would breathe in for a count of five, hold the breath for a count of five, and then breathe out for a count of five, imagining that all the tension is leaving your body as you breathe out. Does that make sense? And that you would do that maybe one, two, or three times. And then he says that you can relieve a little bit of your mental tension by imagining that there's a gate in front of you in space, and that as you breathe out, you send your breath out through the gate, and that accompanying your breath is all of your thoughts, feelings, and emotions, good, bad, indifferent, and that they turn into golden light on the other side of the gate and then fill the whole room you're sitting in. It's the golden light of universal compassion. And so there's a softness, isn't there, that arises, sort of a mental softness that arises from giving away all of your thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And I would do that for like the first few breaths and then return to being attentive to your breath. And that as you notice being tense, then attempt to relax the muscles in your body a bit. Because try that and then let's talk again, okay? Because I'm really interested in seeing this, because I do think that this is a variation for human beings. There are some human beings who experience meditation as being more tense than relaxing. So we need to think about how that is to make it doable for you. Does that make sense? So let's keep talking, okay? Well, yes, sir.
When I first started, I was very similar to you. Sitting down and meditating was painful.
Yeah, painful, yeah.
Especially in my back. And it was painful so much because I was never able to relax, you know.
Right.
Because what I figured out is that my natural posture is terrible.
Oh, your natural posture is terrible. Okay, yeah.
Guilty
as charged, me too.
And what I'm doing is when I'm sitting down, I'm actually correcting something that's wrong.
All the rest of the time, you're, yeah.
You know, uh-huh. And I notice myself throughout the day now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's taken a couple of years to where I'm actually conscious of it.
Right.
Where I'm slouched and my shoulders mm-hmm. are forward and I'm, you know, like carrying weight. And so it's a slow process.
Uh-huh. Sure.
There has been for me to you know, to get rid of 40 years of poor posture.
Right. Yeah, I know.
It just kind of happened right away. And
right.
And my question is, at what time does that become counterproductive where it's hurting my meditation?
Where is it hurting your
meditation? It's counterproductive for me correcting my posture.
And
sometimes it takes away from my meditation time.
Okay. Are you saying correcting your posture while you're on your seat?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It depends. It depends on sort of what mental attitude you're having. If you're having, because we were talking, this goes with the previous question also about being startled. I just now thought of something else to say to you about this, which is when you jump like that, smile a little bit and then put your shoulders down. You know what I mean? It's like use it as a prompt to just let go, you know? Say, oh, thank you for reminding me. Because it's very similar to this question, the questioner here, because at first there's all this pain, and then you realize that the pain that you had in meditation was because of your posture when you're not meditating and so forth. And your question is, when does adjusting your posture on your meditation seat become counterproductive? I think when it's accompanied by excessive judgment is when it becomes counterproductive. Like, I'm, you know, like the sentence would be, I am a bad meditator because. And you know what I'm saying? If it feeds some kind of negative narrative, like I get startled when I meditate, so I am a bad meditator because, you know, or I have pain. I still, by the way, have pain when I meditate. So it's like, I am a bad meditator because we form a judgment about it. And what's so funny is the judgment is kind of like, it's kind of arbitrary. You know, because we all get startled when we, you know. By the way, you'll love knowing this, that not being startled is one of the signs of an enlightened being. So, shh, okay. Kempo Karth Rinpoche was sitting explaining this to us all one afternoon in 3-year retreat. He was sitting next to our ritual master who had just finished teaching us some ritual. Somebody asked about being startled when they meditate, and Rinpoche said, oh, this is how you can tell when somebody has crossed over into the first bhumi of awakening. They're not startled anymore because they've broken through that fixation on self that causes that jump start. At that exact moment, the house was open. It's summer day. You know how it is? A house is open on a summer day, and then doors close and windows close and shades move. At that moment, the door right next to him slammed shut with the wind, and the llama next to him jumped. And Rinpoche did not. Rinpoche did not jump. And so he just looked at us. And I said to myself, point taken. So I think that what we're looking for is to quiet excessive judgment and to recognize that we will, because we have habits of self-judgment, to realize that we have to let go of even those. A little bit of housekeeping's not bad, you know, to adjust your posture from time to time. But if you find that it makes you fidgety, that's probably you're going too far. Yeah. Oh, boy, I may not cover any of my topic, but, you know, is it okay? Is it okay if I just keep doing this? Is this useful for you guys? Okay, we got 1, 2, 3, okay? Yeah, sorry about that, Arvin.
On the topic of judgment, I heard something recently, I think it was Mingyur Rinpoche, said that when you notice that you have gone into discursive thought, the most common reaction is to have a moment of judgment about it.
Okay.
Punish yourself a little bit for having...
Oh.
Drifted off from your awareness.
Okay.
And he what he said, what I started doing that's really helped me, is he said instead, have a little tiny celebration, like a welcoming poem, when you return to your non-judgmental thought.
Cool.
Instead.
Right.
It's just celebrating the I'm back, as opposed to, oh, rats, I've gone away.
I think this is really useful, just to repeat again briefly for the recording. Mingyur Rinpoche's teaching, saying that we do tend to like kind of beat ourselves up a little bit when we wander. If instead we use it as a moment of little celebration, I noticed and I came back. And I do think this is very positive. And see, and this we were talking earlier about rebranding, you know, what's going on, you know, reformulating or reframing what's going on. And I think that this is what was so valuable about what Mingyur Rinpoche said was it's very similar to what Trungpa Rinpoche said when he said, come back and call it a fresh start. And I think that this is very brilliant, really, because that way we're not so weighed down by the fact that we were distracted, because it's not about a perfect performance of non-distractedness. Kemp Rinpoche said it's impossible to be undistracted. It's absolutely impossible, especially at first. So what you will have is short periods of attention that gradually get a few seconds longer. That's what you'll actually have. Short periods of attention followed by periods of wandering, but the periods of wandering will get shorter and your ability to come back will be quicker. And so this, it is a cause for celebration. I really appreciate you sharing that.
And I also noticed that if I hear a noise distance somewhere, more often than not, it just sort of opens me back up so that if I've sort of gotten
closed in. Like tunnel vision, that the sound wakes you up.
Then it sort of expands my awareness.
That's kind of cool.
Actually, I kind of like it. So okay. I'm like, oh, that's right, I'm here in this room now.
Right. I do think that housekeeping has a place in meditation, you know, sort of like you're saying that when you hear that noise and it kind of wakes you up, it brings you back to, oh yeah, like I've maybe gotten a little tunnel vision in my meditation, kind of over-focused a bit, and now this opens me up again. I just love this. I'm so glad we're talking about all this. I may or may not cover this topic, but I will go on for just a few more minutes, but then I have to actually cover like two more pieces of information. So, but thank you. Yes, in the back.
I've been coming here for 10 years, you know, off and on.
Thank you for coming here for 10 years. Yeah.
My practice is not the best, but you know what I do is what I make it here on Sundays. Before I came here, you know, it was kind of like it was like the Jimmy Whitmer show. I just had this constant running commentary.
A running commentary, yeah. Okay.
I don't have feelings that are really bad.
Okay, sure.
There's no real logic to them.
No, I understand.
But when I have to, but then while I'm fishing, I find I have to just go with it.
Yeah.
I have to go with it.
Sure.
Feel what I feel.
Sure.
And get past it.
Sure.
And I, you know, I wonder if there's a point where, you know, where I can recognize and get past the feeling.
Sure.
Sure.
Sure. The idea of feeling discomforting feelings that when you are able to let go of thoughts, somehow, well, I'm repeating, you know, for the recording, see if I get the gist of it, is that when you let go of thoughts, sometimes what's left are feelings, and some of them are not good feelings. And so you're asking about, is there a point where you can overcome these feelings as well? Is that what, or, and I do believe that it's true. I do believe that it's true that there will be a time when you will be able to cope with them better and come back more quickly from them. Because I am not sure that our minds will ever stop thinking or feeling or having emotion. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think our minds will ever stop, because this is really what our mind is. They, the Tibetans use in some texts where they talk about the mind, they say the mind is like the sun, and our thoughts, feelings, and emotions are like the rays of that sun. So you can't, and it's the same with the ocean is the other metaphor, where the ocean is the mind and the thoughts, feelings, and emotions are like the waves. The thoughts, feelings, and emotions are never different or separate from the mind. And if we can see them as just a movement of the mind and nothing more, this is where we're heading in that direction. It's not that we're going to become unfeeling. It's not like that. It's that we're going to recognize as the feeling arises, I see there's a feeling arising, and then just returning the attention to the breath again. And yes, you're right. Because of our habits of thinking, that sometimes some feelings we will call good feelings and some feelings we will call bad feelings, but that's habit, okay? And so slowly, it's like a thought that we think so much, we think it's part of us, and it's important, you know? So, but all feelings, even feelings, start as little tiny thoughts. They're a thought before they're a feeling, really. They're all, the Buddha didn't even differentiate when he taught about them. He didn't say, oh, this is about feelings, this is about emotions, this is about thoughts. He called them all mental events. I had a mental event? Wow! You know, so in that way, since they're all, since the playing field's kind of level when they're all mental events, right? You can let go of a feeling just the same, but the habit will make you feel bad for letting it go because it's a feeling and it's more important. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, but we also have to recognize that giving in and following feelings is just as non-productive as giving in and following thoughts. Does that make sense? So slowly. So the answer is, yeah, you will be able to work with them more quickly, because we were talking about how quickly you can deal with a thought and then let it go and come back. I think you can do it. And I'm so happy that you've been meditating with us all this time. I really appreciate you bringing yourself to this room day after, you know, week after week, you know? So we'll keep talking about it, okay? We'll keep check in with me about this in a week or two. We'll talk about it some more. Then Arvin, and then I have two things to present. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. First is for my own practice. I want to come out like this mention.
Mm-hmm.
So I do yoga. Kind of a
bond. I don't know what bandhas are in yoga. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
But you and I try to kind of use that in my meditation. But then, you know, I hear you talk about just breathing naturally.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if
yeah.
I'm confusing you or
yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that the discipline of yogic breathing should remain in the yogic setting. That it's probably not wise to mix yogic breathing with a shamatha session. You can do it before you do your shamatha session, but I wouldn't mix them up. I would allow your breath to be natural, because part of what's going on, and actually all of these questions have a similarity, that it's about balance. It's about balancing attention with relaxation. You know, there's relaxation and there's tension, and slowly we have to learn how to balance both of them. And so being able to allow your breath to be natural and not try to control it is another balance we have to learn. So yeah, it's good to keep them separate. Okay, and then second?
And then, and this is based off of, you know, the diamond posture is enlightenment itself.
Mm-hmm. That's what they say, yeah. that sitting in the diamond posture is enlightenment
right.
itself, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like a physical, yeah.
And I've seen Tibetan medical mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
The breath going
mm-hmm.
down
sure. Mm-hmm.
And then I've also seen, you know, pictures of, like, I guess, sculpture.
Mm-hmm, sure. Mm-hmm.
Of the Buddha. I think it was meditating. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if there's maybe different techniques depending on the culture you're in.
Yeah, sure.
Because I know that it's easier for me to get in a meditative state when I'm sitting here.
I get it.
Versus when I'm laying down.
No, I get it. And so here's the thing. The lying down posture that you see statues representing the Buddha is the Buddha on his deathbed. And he chose to lie down to demonstrate this. And I think he did it for a reason. And that there was actually a specific posture of his hands that were closing specific orifices on his face and so forth in order to have his breathing through the left channel. So of his energy system. And so... Here, this gives me an opportunity to say that that the death posture is something that we can all slowly learn how to do by merely going to sleep on the right side at night. Kemper Bache said, practice it. It's kind of good. Just from time to time, if you're a stomach sleeper or a back sleeper or whatever, he said, just from time to time, try to sleep on your right side just to kind of get used to the idea so that in case you ever need to do this, it's a useful thing. Secondly, yoga is all of the different yogic techniques, and which Bokarma Bishe actually talks a little bit about this. And he says why sitting in the lotus posture or the diamond posture is so good is because it does even out and balance out the energies in your body, which makes it easier for you to place your attention. However, for a person who's not real skilled at it, it's a pain festival. And they just cannot place their attention on anything. Therefore, it's best to use whatever posture is good for you to use at the beginning, get used to that, and then slowly work on the lotus posture. I am not able to do it now. I used to be able to do it, can't do it now. But that doesn't mean that my meditation is not going to be good. My meditation will be what it is because I have, for many years, just tried to practice again and again and again. But yoga has specific, the yoga that comes from the Hindu tradition has specific reasons behind why it does everything, and there's Tibetan yoga as well, and it also has specific reasons that have to do with energies in the body. But if we become overly obsessed with the energies in the body and putting, then that doesn't work either. It becomes what I call flip switch dharma, where you try to put your body in like a specific position and then get enlightenment on the spot, but it doesn't work like that. you have to have some kind of,
sure.
Yeah. So, but I appreciate you asking that. Yeah, but the idea is that's why you do them in discrete.
I wasn't even thinking about yoga. I was just saying, let's say you want to meditate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what Bokar Rinpoche says about this. He says the relationship between posture, circulation of the of what they call the winds in the subtle channels, and the consequent disruptions of the mind is illustrated by the mental distortions caused by incorrect position of the trunk, and therefore the vertebrae, which are the axis of the body. He said if one leans slightly toward the left, it is traditionally explained that one will at first fall into a sense of well-being, which will degenerate into feelings of desire. If one leans forward, one senses at first an absence of thoughts, which will then degenerate into mental obscurity. If one leans backwards, one first has a sensation of emptiness, which will then degenerate into feeling pride. And if one leans to the right, one first has a feeling of clarity, which will then degenerate also into a feeling of pride. So the idea then is it's good to have a good posture to avoid other problems that can arise from what actually happens. If you want a really good explanation of the movement of energy in the body from the meditation posture, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths, explains the whole thing in the chapter on shamatha. And the couple pieces of information that I want to impart to you now is that you don't have to only rely on meditation on breath. Some people find that being attentive to their breath actually makes them feel claustrophobic. I've actually had people report that. And so I tell them, well, good, then you can use either the pebble method of meditation, placing a pebble on the table in front of you. And then it has to be a nice, even round, not round, but this is oblong, but a pebble, very simple pebble that doesn't have a lot of special coloring to it. It's just place that on the table in front of you, and you can place your attention on it. Now, literally, your eyes can look at it forever, but your attention won't stay. Your attention will wander. And so the job is to return your attention to the pebble when the attention wanders, and to use a visual object. That's called meditating on an impure object, meaning it's mundane. Then the other is to use a pure object, where you can either visualize an image of the Buddha in front of you, or actually take a picture of the Buddha and sit it in front of you, or a statue and put that in front of you, and allow your mind, your eyes and mind to be together on the image of the Buddha, not remarking, oh, this is a nice image, or why does it look like that? But just allow your attention to rest on it. Now, what you would do, how you would do this, would be you would apply this attention for short periods of time, maybe a minute or 2 minutes or even less. Just place your attention on it for a short period of time, take your eyes off of it, relax a bit, and then place your attention again, and then relax, and then again, and do this several times in maybe a 5 or 10 minute period. And that's another way of learning how to place your attention on something. The reason I wanted to share this was because I did promise I would cover the material in Bokhar Rinpoche's book. And he does say that for some people, breath awareness meditation is not the best. So what the reason I'm sharing these two techniques is that if you should find some time that it's important for you to use it, you can do that. And so what he's saying in the end is that we have now seen there are four possibilities for meditation on the breath, on the support of the stone or the image of the Buddha, or even without support, which is explained as Eric explained the last time he was here, by allowing your attention to rest on the mind's awareness, which is very, very complex. So it's not something we teach right away. It's the one that's taught, don't prolong the past, don't invite the future, don't analyze the present, but rather rest in the moment, the present moment of mind's awareness. And so we'll end by doing a short period of that meditation. So placing your body in the posture of meditation, forming the mental intention to meditate for the benefit of beings, we begin by taking one deep breath, breathing out, and then allowing the breath to come and go for just a moment. And then I'll read Tilopa's four instructions. He says, don't prolong the past. Don't invite the future. And don't analyze the present, but rather rest in the present moment of mind's awareness. The mind is aware of what the eyes see. The mind is aware of what the ears hear. And the mind can also be aware of awareness. Taking that awareness as the object of meditation, one can relax one's mind. Thank you so much for being with us for this, I guess you would call it laboratory experience of meditation. And I hope that you can take some encouragement from this back home to your meditation seat, and then come back and practice with us again next week. We'll be back. We'll be back here again next week to meditate at 10, and then the class will be at 11:30 as before. Let's sit quietly and mentally dedicate the goodness of this session. We dedicate the goodness of this session to all suffering beings. May all beings be free of suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood, and coming to awakening, may they benefit all sentient beings. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, the sound department. And we'll see you next time.